This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is the legendary Stuart Brand, who has spent more than half a century shaping how we think about technology, the environment, and the future. He first came to prominence in the 1960s as a merry prankster and the co-creator of the Whole Earth Catalog, the counterculture Bible that helped inspire personal computing, the hacker ethic, and the modern environmentalist movement. Since then, he's launched the Long Now Foundation, championed nuclear power and de-extinction, and he's pushed us to think in 10,000-year time horizons. He's also been the subject of two biographies and an excellent documentary in 2020 called We Are As Gods. In his new book, Maintenance of Everything, Part 1, the 87-year-old Brand argues that the real work of civilization isn't flashy invention, but the long, patient care of complex systems. We talk about that and whether his vision of planetary stewardship conflicts with libertarian values of individualism and decentralized power. Here is the Reason Interview with Stuart Brand. Stuart Brand, thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Well, it's a pleasure. As usual, we've done this before.
That's right. And hopefully we'll do it again. So, you know, the book Maintenance of Everything, which is out from Stripe Press, and it was on a site people can find this. It'll be in the show notes, but just Google it, you know, on a site called Works in Progress, where you were writing drafts and then people were writing in and kind of saying, well, I don't like that or this or whatever. But, you know, talk maintenance is the hidden foundation of everything that we do. You know, maintenance, not, you know, the big new thing, the shiny new things. What do we miss culturally and politically when we focus on innovation, on creative destruction, on disruption, and forget about, you know, going out and checking that everything is tied down the right way on a daily basis?
I don't think they're opposed. There's kind of a man bites dog story about maintenance. Some tell that we put too much emphasis on innovation and not enough on keeping the things going that were innovated long ago, and let's keep going. That's important. A lot of innovation comes out of maintenance. People who know how to, who figure out how to improve a thing, are often the ones who are stuck with keeping it going and realizing how difficult that is, and gee, we could make it easier this way or that way, or what if we just throw this stupid thing away and get something better, which is all part of the process of keeping something going. We often think of maintenance in terms of preventive maintenance. Repair is such a big hassle, and something breaks, and you've got to, you know, it's a trauma to you and to the system that the thing is part of. And so we spend some of our time doing the kind of very unrewarding thing of changing the oil and brushing your teeth so that your teeth don't fall out and your car doesn't blow up. But really, maintenance, it's the whole complete process of keeping the thing going. And like, for example, right now I'm sort of writing on the history of agriculture in a way, because if you're an animal, you've got to keep it fed. We are animals, and we have to keep ourselves fed, and the process of doing that has been one innovation after another, but but as far as for maintenance, so there you have it.
Yeah. Do you, you know, one of the joys of the book, for me anyway, is somebody who remembers the old cars, you know, that had carburetors and spark plugs and points and things like that on each one of which, whenever I tried to do my own tune-ups, I ended up destroying the car. But you talk a lot about, you know, the having a VW bus and you know, that the Volkswagen, you, at one point you talk about how there were, you know, the three cars that became the biggest cars in the world, all, you know, were predicated upon kind of, you know, they were relatively simple and they were relatively, you know, you learned how to maintain them and, as you were saying, how to keep them going. And that's the Model T, the Volkswagen Beetle, and to some degree a minivan or the old Volkswagen camper van, and the Lada, which was interesting, the Soviet car that gets made fun of a lot, but, and it was kind of a crappy car, but you could keep it going forever. Did you have a particular moment where you had a catastrophic engine fail because you didn't do an oil change or you didn't take care of a little thing? And, you know, when did you start, you know, when did you become hip to the idea that, like, oh, you know what, maintaining it every day isn't flashy, but it's absolutely the thing that has, you know, that we have to keep doing?
Well, I'm two wrong things to be a good maintainer. I'm an optimist, and good maintainers are a realist, or anybody else would call them a pessimist. And I'm a hippie by, you know, at that time. Hippies were all about living in the moment. And being good about maintenance is the opposite of living in the moment. It really is having a kind of a lifetime, not your lifetime, well, eventually your lifetime, that's what I do now, but the lifetime of the thing that you're responsible for. And I think we sort of either enter into contracts with, properly, a good maintainer. Well, you enter into a contract that is of a thing you take responsibility for. If you have a child, you've got to keep it fed. If there's a knife you use a lot, you're crazy if you don't keep it sharp. Right. And maybe one of the attractions for doing this book for me was that I'm not really very good at it. My wife is fantastic at it. And she can come up with scary scenarios immediately on anything that is proposed. And in a way, operating to head off scary scenarios is what good maintenance is about.
Do you feel, as a society, and you know, even invoking, you know, a society, I realize I may be going down the wrong path here, but, you know, part of what you talk about in Maintenance of Everything is the history of, you know, of removal, interchangeable parts, about right. The development of making it easier for people to fix part of something rather than having to throw out, you know, the whole horse and wagon or the whole gun if one little piece breaks. But as a society, you also talk about how it seemed like invention was the necessity is the mother of invention, in the sense of when you're living, you know, in, say, the United States, where you might be miles away from your neighbor and you have a piece of machinery that could be simple or it could be complex, but you have to figure it out how to do it. There was this sense that people were more, you know, they had better mastery over their tools because they relied on them more. Do you feel, as a society, we don't quite have that same ethos anymore? And, you know, that are the machines that we use to live and to prosper are kind of mysterious to us. We don't open up computers the way that we used to. We don't open up, you know, all sorts of, we don't, you know, cars. Like, it's very hard if you're, you know, to work on modern cars. They're better, but they're kind of foreign to us.
Well, there's a couple things there. The Model T was designed to be maintained and tailored any old which way. Henry Ford grew up on a farm in the Midwest. He knew that farmers and ranchers were very good at fixing their own stuff. And so he counted on that. And then because the Model T stayed the Model T, and millions of them were made and used and got old, went in the junkyards, and then got completely pillaged in the junkyards for the parts, because 20 years later, a part from a really old Model T would fit in your brand new Model T. But I'm glad you brought up the bit about interchangeable parts, because it's the most probably anti-libertarian, anti-reason magazine section of the book in that it was government people who for 40 years in the War Department, the Ordnance Department specifically, spent millions of dollars, which now would be a lot more than that, trying to get manufacturers in the U.S. capable of making interchangeable parts. And it turns out you have to get down to about a 50th of a millimeter accuracy in order for that to actually work. And they did it. And that's why America wound up taking the lead in the manufacturing part of the Industrial Revolution. We led the way. It became called the American system because we not only... it turned out that the way to get really good interchangeable parts was to basically automate the machine tools that made them. And so Henry Ford never allowed anybody to use a file on the assembly line, because as soon as he took a part and filed it to fit better, that would slowly stop the assembly line. And with guns, if your gun failed and you're military and you're in the field and you need to fix it, you've got to find a gunsmith, which is not going to be anywhere near the battlefield. And they'll file a part to get it put in there, or they'll make it from scratch. Once they're interchangeable, then you know, like the AK-47, any piece of any AK-47 will substitute just fine. In the very roughly designed and built AK-47 assault rifle. So I see that process in the 19th century as being what led to DARPA. The researchers, I kind of don't call it military enterprise. And I don't know, do you feel okay about DARPA?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of things to think about in that, of the idea of interchangeable parts. Of course, you know, like if you're an individualist, I'm not interchangeable. Like, I'm not like anybody else, right? Like the old Kink song.
How dare you say blah, blah.
Yeah, I can be replaced. No, absolutely not. But one of the things that you stress is that when you create a system that allows for interchangeable parts, like part of what you give up is precision. So, you know, and with cars, I thought this was really fascinating when you talked about the founder of Rolls-Royce. And Rolls-Royce created these essentially artisanal cars that can, you know, command massive premiums in the market because they're all unique and they all, you know, are according to their own kind of, you know, specifications. Henry Ford with the Model T actually made a car that was much less precise. It wasn't as efficient. It wasn't as elegant. But because of that, it's able to become massified. And ironically, I mean, this kind of pushes back on part of what you're saying, you know, because the Model T was ubiquitous, people started adapting it. You have photos in the book of, you know, people who make snow plows out of Model Ts and all. You can just endlessly kind of adapt it to whatever you want. So I mean, from a kind of libertarian point of view, I find it very challenging and very interesting to be like, okay, how do interchangeable parts end up possibly creating a much more robust ecosystem that is also more individualized?
Well, about DARPA, you know what DARPA is behind. I wound up collecting some of the things it's behind, and it's behind everything that is good in the world that we use, and that we get all worked up about, and at fairly low cost, and lots of other entities, including Revive and Restore, is adopting DARPA practice. It's using program managers to closely supervise and pay for, in our case, biotech scientific discovery for conservation, but all kinds of things. So is that okay for the government to do that?
Yeah. I am okay with the government existing. I'm not an anarchist. And I often think about this in the context, and, you know, when you're talking about things like biotech or agriculture and agronomy, you know, the Land Grant College Act that, you know, came out of the Civil War and then came online. You know, on a certain level, it's, you know, it's not great for, if you're being strictly libertarian, everything should be provided by private markets. But the creation of research, you know, mining and technical schools, agriculture and technical schools around the country, many of which remain, you know, among the best institutions we have, that definitely helped create a lot more people who are a lot more capable. It created research. You know, I went to Rutgers University, Rutgers College. As an undergrad, and Cook College was the land grant part of that school. And they've developed over the years, they've developed thousands of tomatoes, you know, Jersey tomatoes are. So, you know, it's, it, you know, we can argue about whether or not the costs are worth it in any particular case, but yeah, you get that, you know, where certain types of standards and measurements or certain types of basic research leads to other things. You know, when people often talk about the internet as, you know, coming out of DARPA, it's worth thinking about, yes, it absolutely helped create the early infrastructure. And then at a certain point, the internet became its own thing and it really does not rely on the government anymore. So these are, to go to your point about how, like, these things are not necessarily in opposition to each other. And now the government probably spends more energy trying to shut the internet down in various ways. That it does taking credit for, you know, for allowing it. So if we could, let's go to talk about, you mentioned the AK-47. This is also another fascinating section of the book where you talk about the AK-47, you know, which was created by the Soviet Union, or, you know, and a Soviet gun maker, and is the weapon of choice for armies around the world, for, you know, insurgents, for everybody, because it is relatively simple and easily fixed. And there's a lot of parts for it. And you compare that to the M16, which was the gun that was developed in America and is in a certain way is a great gun. It's a very nice gun, but it's terrible. You know, it was rolled out en masse in Vietnam, and it was terrible for that. It has twice as many parts as the AK-47. It's more subject to corrosion and rust and gunk getting in there. And, you know, how do you square this idea? And I guess this is also true of the Rolls-Royce versus the Model T. It seems like, you know, we're always kind of going between simpler products that might be, you know, more limited in various ways versus, you know, a more aesthetically pleasing or advanced or sophisticated thing. And then it's a question of just trying to find the sweet spot in between those or something.
I don't think so. I think you wind up being rewarded by going in both directions. AK-47s were cheap, and 16s are not cheap. AK-47s operate in the mud, they operate in the sand, they operate in humidity. You know, you can pick one up out of the mud and fire it, and as you fire it, the mud flies out. M16 basically has to be surgically cleaned to function. When it functions, it's absolutely fantastic. 500 meters, you can put a high-velocity small round through a helmet, and Rolls-Royce has prospered and became extremely famous and still are because they were sort of, in a way, perfect. And indeed, you would never try to hot rod a Rolls-Royce. You don't dare touch it in a way because it's so perfectly attuned to itself that all you would do is screw it up. So I think there's always a place in not just the market, but kind of the range of situations and mindsets, or things that are sort of cheap, fast, and just barely in control, and things that are exquisitely tuned to perfection if they're in relatively perfect circumstances. And exploring both of those as a good direction to explore the whole field of design, I think is always worth doing.
Hey, Reason Interview listeners, robots are coming for our jobs. Can you compete? Are you or someone you care about wondering how to stay relevant as artificial intelligence reshapes work, careers, and opportunity? Reliance College invites students and young professionals to AI-Proof You, a new multi-module intensive certificate program focused on building the human skills that machines can't replace. Judgment, independent thinking, clear communication, leadership, entrepreneurial initiative. AI-Proof You begins with a three-day in-person intensive meeting in Austin, Texas. From there, participants continue with 6 weeks of guided virtual seminars, and the program concludes with a three-day in-person capstone in Chicago. This isn't a coding boot camp or tool training course. AI-Proof You teaches participants how to think, decide, and lead in an AI-driven world. The next cohort begins March 20th. Robots are coming for your job. Can you compete? Discover the education built for the age of AI. To learn more and apply, visit reliancecollege.org/AI. That's reliancecollege.org/AI. And now, back to the Reason interview. To go back to an earlier question, do you feel as a society, you grew up as a tinkerer, what used to be called a tinkerer, right? You would find tools or machines
I was a relatively obedient son of a civil engineer out of MIT who had a bench in the basement.
But you would take stuff apart, right?
I would definitely take stuff apart.
Yeah.
People who really like to take stuff apart like to put it back together. That's not me.
Yeah. Okay. So you were happy. Well,
I took it apart to find out what its secrets were. That's valid. And tear downs are a whole thing on YouTube.
Yeah.
People take things apart. But I have a friend who, when he was growing up, a young man, he got a Harley Davidson, and every year at Christmas, he would take it apart down to the last washer and nut, and then put it back together with complete joy.
Yeah.
That is quite foreign to me.
Yeah, I took a lawnmower apart once growing up, and I put it back together, but I didn't realize what gaskets were for or grease. I knew you needed oil in it, and when I turned it over, the engine just kind of seized up immediately. So that was a learning experience. But to talk about that interest in taking things apart to see how they work, you talk in the book about how manuals are a great thing, and for anything that you're working on or thinking about, you should have two manuals, and the one is that the actual manufacturer gives out, and then the second one is the thing that tinkerers come up with.
Right.
So you talk about, there's a motor, the Honda or Harley Davidson will give you a manual with the motorcycle. And then there is the guide that somebody writes about. The Whole Earth catalog was kind of like that second manual in a way, but where does the energy or the insight to write the manual that comments on the official manual come from?
Well, you see it in YouTube now. Manuals have been largely replaced by YouTube. Certainly the Whole Earth catalog has been replaced by YouTube. And we conferred agency in a way with the Whole Earth catalog, but YouTube confers agency 100 or 1,000x times more. Widely and properly. So when something breaks, it used to be you kind of despaired. You would search around for the manual and you couldn't find it. You're trying to think, well, who knows how to fix this kind of thing? Where are they? And you give up. And now you just put in a couple of keywords and Google and go to the YouTube. And you can tell the make, model, and year of the thing that. And the kind of breakage that you have, and there will be not just one, but probably half a dozen videos of various characters showing you exactly a bunch of often different techniques to solve the problem that you have. And it's one of the richest sources of a better life that the internet provides.
Yeah, so, at one point you write, YouTube is a damn miracle. I underscore that. And you recommend that people pay the $12 a month or whatever it is to get rid of the ads on YouTube, that it's worth it.
I understand advertising. My father was an advertising man. If I can afford to not get it for free and have the ads go away, I'm typically pleased to do that.
What, you know, when you think of, and it was striking to me, writing about YouTube and being so excited about it, because YouTube is often, and things online are often they're discussed in terms of they're horrible, people are afraid of them. We have gone from, eras of relative techno-optimism to techno-pessimism. When you look at something like YouTube, which, and the biggest genre of stuff on YouTube are how-to videos, how to do everything, how to remake your life or remake your blender, all sorts of stuff. What do you think drives the pessimism? That seems to be quite strong when in certainly in the West.
That's a really good question, and that's why I'm not immediately having an answer to it. Something there is that doesn't love a cool new thing that wants it down, because these silly people over here that I think are stupid or highfalutin or whatever, they think that because they see a way that this thing might be wonderful and useful. My public duty is to show that, there's a really quite plausible way it can not only be useless, but quite destructive. And here's my story about how that'll go. Environmentalism went crazy in that direction. Mm-hmm. And so everybody was immediately afraid of genetically modified anything, immediately afraid of nuclear energy. They were immediately afraid of the space program. They thought it was a waste of time, blah, blah, blah. I was an environmentalist at that time. I'm a conservationist now.
Yeah. And your work on, among other things, the campaign to have NASA release a photograph of the whole Earth, helped inspire the first Earth Day. So you're underselling your bona fides as a person who helped create the environmentalist mindset. So when you say they went too far, it carries a lot of weight.
Well, hippies were anti-technology. Romantics in general are anti-technology. Mm-hmm. Right. And John Henry is always going to get the song, "The Steam Drill Never Does." But the steam drill is actually a better way to do that kind of work. The French Revolution, where the idea of interchangeable parts for guns, for muskets then, was actually started. The French Revolution said, don't do that because these nice gun makers will be out of work. And so they actually shut down the guy named Blanc, who was building interchangeable parts for muskets. And France went in the course of the generation from having the best muskets in Europe to having the worst muskets in Europe. And so there was no taking account of, is this beneficial for the customer? In that case, soldiers. And that keeps happening. So the romantic anti-technology is almost always one wrong and two mistaken in its arguments. The way to critique a new anything, AI now, is to embrace it and experiment with it, make mistakes with it, see if you can break it, red team it, do all these things to sharpen it. And if in the course of that you decide, you know what, this is a blind alley and we need to back out of it. That, the critique from people who have done that is a valid critique. If people are just imagining problems, you can always imagine more problems and you can imagine more ways of things actually going right. My wife, Ryan Phelan, with Revive and Restore, had a workshop a couple of years ago called Intended Consequences. And it was about how actually conservation, that when it intervenes, mostly is successful because the biology, the ecology, my old field, is now, you know, sound enough and predictive enough that when you introduce a species or do various things that might help the ecosystem in general, by and large, it does that. And the times it doesn't do that, it's just neutral. It did no harm. But the people who are saying you can't do that are just dead sure that it's going to do harm.
Right. Do you, with AI, do you have, what do you think is the strongest critique of artificial intelligence as it's being rolled out now? Or what are the things that we should be testing it on most strongly to see if it's something that we're not really going to embrace or shouldn't embrace?
I'm not in the thick of that, but I do know a lot of the people who are in the thick of that. And I trust them to investigate the ways it can go wrong. And they'll be able to head off some of them. They won't be able to head off all of them. And some of them will go probably pretty calamitous. And then we negotiate. The use of AIs and weapons is clearly going to be played out very quickly because the militaries always grab new technologies and turn them into weapons. And rightfully so from their standpoint. It could be a thing like the use of gas that gets sort of tabooed after a while. The use of nuclear weapons, even tactical ones, has been tabooed for quite a while. And anybody who unleashed one now, everything has to do with the threat and, you know, the massive amount of testing that went on in the 50s and 60s was negotiating with threat. But once you had mutual assured destruction with the second strike capability, that actually put a stop to it. And that was, in a way, why it was developed. So some problems turn out to be non-existent. Some problems turn out to be easy to recognize and solve. And some problems are really hard to solve, and it takes a while. I think we'll go through all of that with AIs.
You know, your work, certainly Maintenance of Everything, but also in previous books, you talk about maintaining complex systems. You've talked about how, the government has helped create or fund basic research or put into place certain systems. Do you think, is the government good at running the system, or is it better at inspiring it? Or, because within your own work, and I know you're libertarian friendly, you're libertarian curious, you're libertarian adjacent, but yeah, I don't think you call yourself a libertarian, but, do decentralized networks tend to do a better job of kind of figuring out what are the optimal applications for things and checking and balancing, the potential problems?
Well, the market is one such network, and it is very often excellent on things, especially in a certain kind of time frame. Government, when it is working well, works in a longer time frame, and so it can be good at doing blue sky, no expected reward for a while type of innovation such as DARPA does. That's a tough sell in business. Various things. Where are you going with the question, Tom?
Well, I'm just, we seem to be at, you know, in, if, you know, history rhymes and, you know, when you look back in, you know, in the late 60s, you know, there was a fair amount of political violence. There was more political violence than there is now. And more importantly, it was undergirded by a series of people who actually, you know, believed that political violence was the answer. And that was kind of taken seriously in a way that I don't think it is so much now, but the country seemed to be coming apart, like the America. You know, we had presidents, you know, Richard Nixon won in a three-way race in 1968, getting something like 43 or 44% of the vote. Like, you know, there was not a consensus about things. We seem to be back in something like that, where there's a lot of polarization, there's a lot of demonization, there is political violence. And, you know, is the political system robust enough to, you know, kind of keep things in check? Or is it, you know, is it just not working anymore? Or how do we... how do we create a consensual government system where we get most of the benefits with fewer of the harsh costs?
Well, this is actually an interesting time to be alive right now, because all of that is kind of up for proof, up for grabs, up for there's a lot of grabbing going on. And the system was designed to be ungrabbable. But it's been grabbed. And so can it, how far down that path of having been grabbed does it go before it becomes stuck there? And that's what we're in the process of finding out. I think I'm pretty, I think there's lots of reasons to find its way back to some kind of balance. It'll be different than before. The systems will be different than before. We may have different political parties with different names. But I think the basic apparatus in the towns, to a large degree in the states, is pretty intact, and we'll find a way to by the new kind of center of balance and balance there. But we'll see.
Yeah. Do you, you know, the Whole Earth Catalog announced that, or you announced in the Whole Earth Catalog, we are as gods and might as well get good at it. You know, and that got, I guess, the Whole Earth Catalog, the first issue came out in 1968. So we're coming up on 60 years. It's, you know, whatever it is, 58 years since. Do you think we've gotten pretty good at it, or are we getting better at it?
Well, the big test will be climate. We've certainly gotten better at it. A whole lot of godlike powers, and God with a small g. These are, Greek gods, ancient Greek gods, not the Almighty. We haven't really attempted anything in terms of maintenance of the planet at planet scale, at planet pace. And with climate change, we're dealing with a big, deep, slow process. So, there's no instant cures. Well, there's some that are better than others. I think geoengineering is one that will come to just because the cost of continually rising temperatures and rising ocean will make it seem like, you know, this is the low cost way to buy enough time to really convert all of our energy systems to basically non-combustion. And that will be a different planet, a different society, a different global civilization. Because it's not economic. There's a global economy, but there's no such thing as a planetary economy. The things that matter at planet scale are not measurable in dollars and cents. But they are measurable in... well, the great thing of the advance of science is that we have lots and lots of capabilities of sensing when something is going wrong and what exactly is going wrong in that thing. And in terms of maintenance, the ability to do that kind of sensing is crucial. They call it predictive maintenance. And before the thing breaks, you have indications that would like to break. And that's when you try to head it off, and often you can. So far, we've not fully succeeded in doing that with climate. We've gone a long way, much farther into solar than I would ever have thought. We were pushing solar 60 years ago on the whole Earth catalog. In a big way, and amongst our crowd, we thought, this is obvious. But it took a while for it to become cheap and easy. And I've just been comparing, if you're a farmer and you have 100 acres that you're farming, you can get a certain amount of food out of it. And, even with precision farming, it's going to be just a certain amount. Well, let some company put a whole bunch of solar collectors on your 100 acres and you lease it to them, you get 10x to 100x the money and none of the hassle. So the cheap, abundant source of energy is increasingly becoming the sun.
Right.
And there's quite a lot of sunlight. There'll be even more in orbit as these guys are trying to figure out how to start having major data centers in space.
Yeah, that's so amazing, because the sun never sets, right, in outer space. So there's a lot of potential energy up there and figuring out how to bring it down.
And you can, you focus pointed at the sun and it stays pointed.
Yeah. Do you feel the globe is, or, the planet is growing up a bit about nuclear energy? You rankled a lot of people kind of in the environmentalist movement when you were like, nuclear power makes obvious sense. If you want to, reduce various kinds of emissions and, minimize, impact on the planet. Do you feel like that message is now about to be fully accepted around the world?
I think the opposition got outlived. they were not able to convince younger and younger generations to buy into what turned out to be a false fear. And then very wealthy young people who want to, do AI or want to do crypto or whatever that takes a lot of energy, they sort of look directly at the advantages of nuclear power. They're not looking at it through the history of nuclear weapons, Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Three Mile Island and all that. They're looking at, can this be made safe? Yes. Totally. Is it something that can really scale? Yes. And so nuclear scaling up and solar continuing to scale up looks like they're both going to happen.
I guess as a final question for you, so your latest book is Maintenance of Everything. What are you doing to maintain your legacy, or how, because there will come a time, when you are no longer here. Have you thought about that, or how, how does one go about maintaining their legacy as opposed to, kind of keeping it tight while you're still able to brush your teeth and things like that?
Right. I tried to write a sort of a memoir at one point, as soon as I wrote a line of it, I hated it. I was just, bored with myself. But I didn't have to, because some guys came along and wanted to make a film about me. And this documentary called We Are As Gods was made, and it's good. John Markoff came along and wanted to write a biography, and he did, and it's good. All of the whole earthworks we did over 30-plus years is now online at wholeearth.info. And so I have my legacy has gone ahead and somehow established itself. It's not something I'm concerned about. So I'm one of the, really very lucky people in that respect.
Does your life, the Markov book, the subtitle is the Many Lives of Stuart Brand, I think, something like that.
It was going to have a better title. It was going to be called Floating Upstream. And because I basically designed a lot around my laziness. It's the sort of hacker shortcut that can make good things happen.
But when you look at the different points of your life, from being an engineer to becoming a merry prankster, to starting the Whole Earth Catalog, to looking at Xerox PARC and all of the kind of interesting personal computing stuff coming out of that, to the well, to, the Long Now, et cetera. Like, does your life make sense to you? How do you make sense of it? Because you have had a unique life. You've had a particular influence both across time and in a lot of different fields. So there's no reason to think that, that somebody who starts out in a psychedelic counterculture is going to end up being quoted by Steve Jobs at a college graduation speech, but it seems to make sense. But what puts it all together for you?
I go where curiosity leads me, but I go where I think the action is, and try to get enough of a sense of what's going on there to have an idea of what might be missing. And so when we did the Hackers Conference in 1984, Steve Levy's book called Hackers had just come out before then. And he said there were three generations of hackers. And Kevin Kelly and I said to one another, has anybody ever put those three generations together, see what happens? And screw it, let's do it. And so we did. And it was one of the giddiest 3 days I've ever spent. Those guys absolutely got stoked on each other. Yeah. And the fun they were having. And one of the things that emerged is what hackers want. They wanted to turn everybody into hackers. And my church, a lot of that actually happened. So I'm not a programmer. I'm not a coder. but I could see that the coders were where the action was. And so I figured out what we could do to help that.
A lot of your work also, it does seem to be about bringing people together, across generations, not just, of a particular cohort. Where does that come from, and how do we maintain that? Because I think about it in the various interests that I have in my life, outside of family life, generally the only space where I see a lot of different generations kind of hanging out together in non-hierarchical ways is really the psychedelic community, which is going through a renaissance now. But where did where did that imperative come from? Because even though you're old, you're too old to be a baby boomer, you're kind of the archetypal baby boomer.
Silent generation, they called us.
But, baby boomers didn't want to hang out with their parents. They didn't even necessarily want to hang out with their kids. But here you are, pulling people together. Where does that come from? It seems to be a very big source of strength. How do we maximize that going forward?
I went to only one time I've gone to a reunion. I went to a Stanford reunion. A decade or so after I'd been there. And I couldn't imagine a more boring occasion. Here were people who were exactly my age, all white bread, because at the time, with somebody of color at Stanford, except some very few folks who I got to know because I was involved with foreign students. You want to hang out with people outside your age group because they have stuff that your age group doesn't, in terms of they're the younger ones are are hip to and enthralled by and immersed in new technologies. And they own those technologies as they come along. Once upon a time, psychedelic drugs was owned by my generation, and we figured out what to do with it, what to do wrong with it. So, and then the older people have the benefits of maturity, which are not small, and of a perspective that is, I just have to say they have a longer view because they have a longer body of experience. And one of the things that emerges over time is the long view is where eventually you want to live and have your society live to a large extent. And for me, that wound up being a diagram of face layers of civilization, where you have fashion at one end, and basically governance, culture, and nature is the other. They move very slowly. And a healthy civilization has all of those. You know, and commerce is faster than governance. That's in a way what we were just talking about with DARPA. So these layers keep getting things being proposed into the system from the fast stuff, from fashion and commerce. They keep being kind of integrated and put into framing with everything else by the slow parts. And that combination is what makes the system last a long time, I think.
All right, we're going to end it there. Stuart Brand, thank you for writing Maintenance of Everything and for talking to Reason today.
Well, thank you for having me here.